Welcome, and thank you for standing by. At this time, all participants are in a listen-only mode until the question-and-answer session of today's conference. At that time, you may press star one on your phone to ask a question. I'd like to inform all parties today's conference is being recorded. If you have any objections, you may disconnect at this time. I would now like to turn the conference over to Melissa Gordon. Thank you. You may begin.
Good afternoon, and thank you for joining our call today. My name is Melissa Gordon, and I'm a public information officer for the Virginia Department of Health Office of Communications. Today, we are joined by State Vaccine Coordinator Dr. Danny Avula. He will give an update on the latest developments with the COVID-19 vaccine. Today's call is being moderated by an operator. So when we get to the Q&A part of the call, please follow their instructions to ask a question. And I'd like to welcome Dr. Avula to share a brief update.
Hey, good afternoon, everybody. I hope everyone's doing well this week. We continue to press onward. We're having really good progress with our vaccination campaign. As of today, 41% of the population is fully vaccinated. And when we kind of reframe things, looking at President Biden's goal of 70% of Americans vaccinated with at least one dose by July 4th, we're actually doing great in those regards. We're at 65% today. About if we kind of break that down, there's about 343,000 people left to hit that 70% goal. So 343,000 more adults that we would need a first dose in between now and July 4th to meet it. So that's about 8,000 a day. And we have been tracking a good bit better than that. Over the last week, around 20,000, a little over that per day of first doses. So making some good progress. I think we will definitely get to that goal. And then our numbers have also been bolstered by the expansion to 12 and up. So as you all know, last week Pfizer was approved by the FDA and subsequently the CDC for administration to the 12 to 15 population. And so in just over a week of having that approval and access, we have had 52,649 Virginians who are between the ages of 12 and 15. So it's about 12.5% of that 422,000 people in that category. And so that's a really, really big step for just over a week of vaccinating 12 to 15-year-olds. We will continue to press on as we march towards community immunity here. Couple of quick changes that were made to the dashboard this week, the public-facing dashboard. Hopefully you all saw that. We did add the federally administered doses. So we still have a tab on there that says federal doses, and that monitors all of the doses that are administered by our federal government partners, so the Bureau of Prisons, Department of Defense, the Indian Health Service, and the VA hospital system. And previously, those numbers had not been included in our totals that were presented on the dashboard midweek this week. We added them in just so that our numbers kind of mirror more what you see on the CDC website. And then a couple of other additions to the dashboard that allow folks to track how we're doing in that 18-plus population specifically. And so you'll see that number split out as well so that everyone can track along with us how we're doing on that 70% goal. Otherwise, so much of our work has continued to make that shift away from the large-scale mass vaccination efforts. I mean, we do still have community vaccination centers that are in use and have been used in creative ways. For example, in Prince William County, a lot of that 12 to 15 population has been shuttled over to the CVC, and they're handling a lot of that adolescent vaccination. We are also shifting to, from first to second doses, but also continuing first doses of Pfizer and Moderna, just as we've seen the demand for Johnson & Johnson tail off a bit. So we're continuing to do those in our large units, but we are also shifting more to the mobile units and the targeted efforts, the pop-up clinics that we talked about some last week. And so while those numbers are harder to come by, we certainly are seeing we're certainly seeing a lot of fruit. It's just slower and it's harder, and that's going to be the case for the next 3 to 4 months. Other updates, we talked some last week about the shift to primary care providers and the reality that, the segments of our community who just want that reassurance, want to talk to a healthcare provider, that there are ways that we are making it easier for primary care providers to access vaccine, and the federal government is doing that as well. So a couple of those changes, we in the state now, local health departments and health systems have been playing this role to some degree over the last few months, where they will receive the large shipments of Pfizer, break them down, and redistribute them into more manageable shipments. Because the Pfizer has been delivered up until this point in trays of 1,170 doses. The federal government is going to be a certain percentage of Pfizer shipments starting next week will be in shipments of 450 doses. So they're doing some work on their end to make that easier. But we still have providers who really only want, 30 doses or 50 doses or 100 doses at a time. And so we're going to continue to build out our network of independent pharmacies and hubs that can receive those shipments, break them down, and redistribute them to providers so that they can have manageable amounts. Additionally, there was good news this week, yesterday, that Pfizer, in their latest studies, have shown that that the storage and handling requirements have been updated. And so instead of having a really limited amount of time that Pfizer could be refrigerated, we can now ship things frozen, have them frozen for 2 weeks, and then have a full month at refrigeration temperatures. And so that's going to make it a lot easier for many practices to receive Pfizer, to keep it frozen and transition it to a refrigerator and have a lot more time to work through those doses. So everything is kind of moving in the direction of making things more accessible and more easy to store and handle the vaccine. And we will continue to lean a lot on our primary care providers and increasingly our pediatricians as now the 12 and up population has been approved. So I'll pause there and let's see what questions come up.
Thank you for that update, Dr. Avula. Before we begin the question and answer portion of today's call, I'd like to remind everyone that our call is focused on the latest developments for the COVID-19 vaccine. For questions regarding other topics, please email them to the VDH Communications Office. Contact information is available at vdh.virginia.gov/news. Please remember to limit your inquiries to one question and one follow-up per person to allow time for everyone. Now we'll begin the question and answer portion of today's call. Operator?
Thank you. We'll now begin the question and answer session. If you'd like to ask a question, please press star 1, unmute your phone, and record your name clearly. Your name is required to introduce your question. If you need to withdraw your question, press star 2. Again, to ask a question, please press star 1. It'll take a few moments for the questions to come through. Please stand by. First question is from McKinley Strother. Go ahead. Your line's open.
Hey, Dr. Vula. Good afternoon. I wanted to ask about or get your thoughts on college students being vaccinated as they return in the fall. I don't even know if you're the person I should ask or if there's any one person that I should go to on this topic. We have Virginia Tech here saying that they will not require the vaccine because it's not fully authorized by the FDA. But then you have UVA saying that they will require it for students to come back on campus in the fall. So we were wanting your thoughts on that front.
Yeah, about 3 weeks ago, the Attorney General weighed in on this issue of institutes of higher education and said, it is absolutely within the purview of institutions of higher education to require vaccination if they see fit. So each institution will make that decision on their own. There's actually a website that tracks them. I can't remember. I think if you Google universities and COVID requirements, there's a website that tracks those. And last I checked, there were six or seven Virginia institutions. I think everyone's going to be on their own journey with that. it's possible, especially for the college age students, that we will have a move from an emergency use authorization to a full biologics license from the FDA. Pfizer anticipates submitting all of their data for that sometime this summer, or even by the end of May, actually, because what is required for full licensure is 6 full months of data. So with the adult population, they've reached that, and they're gonna submit for that full licensure. Not exactly sure. The FDA hasn't been super clear about how long it'll take to review that data and potentially come up with their to grant that full licensure. But you know, that'll allay some concerns. But again, the institutions are going to be making those decisions on their own.
Thank you.
Our next question is from Amy Knowles. Go ahead, your line's open.
Hey, Dr. Avula, thanks for taking our questions. I heard that 100 million J&J vaccines were potentially contaminated in Baltimore. I was just curious if this changes Virginia's plan or J&J allocation moving forward.
Yeah, Amy, I'm not sure if that's a new number or a new issue. I remember the Baltimore plant was... Yeah, they found all those issues. I thought that was maybe a month and a half ago. That shut down the ongoing generation of new doses of Johnson & Johnson. And what we had been receiving in the United States was not actually coming from that plant, because that plant had never received FDA authorization. They still, to this point, have not received FDA authorization, and it's part of the reason that we have not seen new distributions of J&J into Virginia over the last 2 weeks. So we have not received any more. We don't anticipate receiving any more until that plant gets its FDA authorization. We do still have somewhere around 30,000 doses that we can order down that you know had already come in to the you know to through the federal ordering pathway. And then there's actually a lot of Johnson & Johnson in circulation. And in fact, I get emails probably every other day from other states that are saying, hey, we have Johnson & Johnson expiring in 2 weeks. We're not going to be able to use it. Can anyone else use it? So that was a long way of saying I don't think it's going to impact our vaccination rollout at all. We have seen the demand for Johnson & Johnson drop off significantly. We continue to have more than we need in circulation here in Virginia and could certainly tap into other states at any time if that demand were to grow.
Awesome. Thank you. And then also as we transition into no restrictions, I was just wondering if you might want to give like a PSA about what practices vaccinated people can feel pretty comfortable about leaving behind, and then which ones they can keep practicing to remain healthy and well.
Yeah, we should be real careful about the language around no restrictions, right? I mean, the CDC guidance is that people who are fully vaccinated, so who are 2 weeks out from their final dose of their vaccine, no longer need to wear masks in any setting. And I think that is really about the science. We've just seen data point after data point over the last couple of months show the effectiveness of vaccine. And I think with the evolution of a couple of other large-scale studies that came out last week, the CDC said we have enough data. We can you know really firmly make this recommendation. We're not worried about people who are fully vaccinated either contracting the disease or spreading the disease, because even if they were to contract it, they have such small amounts of virus. So I think you know what we've done here in Virginia is we've come into alignment with the CDC guidelines, and that should be really encouraging for people. I think for so long people were like, well, if nothing's different about my life, then why should I get vaccinated? And hopefully, this marks a difference, and it's a difference that's based in science. So I think that's the take-home message for everybody who is considering getting vaccinated or who has been vaccinated, is that the data is really good, that you're safe if you're fully vaccinated. And if you were waiting to get vaccinated because you wanted to see this happen, then now's the time. So my hope and you know, jury's still out on whether the numbers are showing it. You know, we've seen some plateauing of the numbers of late, but that's better than a decrease in numbers. So perhaps we will see this sustained interest in getting vaccinated over the next few weeks, which would be good for everybody.
Thank you.
Our next question is from Sierra Jenkins. Go ahead, your line's open.
Hi, Dr. Avula, can you hear me?
Yeah, hi, Sarah.
Hi. So with COVID restrictions lifting next week, Virginia hasn't quite, you know, met that threshold of vaccinating 70 to 75% of its population. So I just wanted to, and if I'm confusing that with the national percentage, please let me know. But is there anything that the health department is trying to do between now and then to kind of speed up that process of getting people vaccinated?
Yeah, I mean, obviously, we've been trying to get as many people vaccinated as quickly as possible, and I think that that sense of urgency hasn't decreased at all, right? What you noted is true nationally, yes, but it's also true for Virginia. We want to get somewhere between 70 and 80% of our population to immunity, and we want the majority of that to happen through vaccination, because remember, natural immunity can also contribute to the concept of herd immunity, right? People who have actually contracted COVID themselves will have some degree of natural immunity. The data has shown that vaccine-mediated immunity actually is much more robust. We see much better antibody results for people who are vaccinated. So we really want to press Virginia to that goal of 70 to 80% of all people vaccinated as we can. Now, obviously, there's a gap because young children aren't eligible to get vaccinated yet. And so realistically, it may not be until we have authorization for younger children that we get to that goal of herd immunity. I guess maybe to clarify what I started out saying in terms of our progress was also the president's goal, which is separate than herd immunity, but the president's goal of saying we want to get to 70% of all adults with at least one dose by July 4th. I think, and as I said in the opening, we're definitely on track. We're at 65% now. It'll take about somewhere between 7,000 and 8,000 new adults newly vaccinated each day for us to meet that goal, which I think we can easily do. So what are we doing? I mean, I think we're continuing to try to reduce barriers to access. We are, getting out to where people are. We are getting more vaccine to providers so that people who are hesitant to have questions can have those questions answered. And again, I hope that the newfound data around the value of vaccination, not only in protecting yourself, but also protecting your community, and now not needing to wear a mask once you're fully vaccinated, we hope that all of those things will be motivators. So, I think there's lots of examples of just where we are trying to be more present, trying to get vaccine out to communities who haven't necessarily had as much access, and we'll continue to do that until we reach our goals.
Thank you.
Our next question is from Alex Littlehales. Go ahead, your line's open.
Hey, Danny, this is Alex from 13 News here in Hampton Roads. I guess I'll ask you to play a little forecasting for me. So, you know, recently the CEOs of both Moderna and Pfizer have expressed that a third booster shot of both of their vaccines could be coming soon, if not available sometime in the fall. And as we know from COVID time, that things happen a lot faster than we all really anticipate. The fall would be just around the corner before we know it. So I just kind of wanted to check in, you know, if booster shots do become available in the coming months, how exactly would that work here in Virginia? I know that's a couple months away, but would it be appointment-based like it has been? Would it be, you know, opened up to walk-up clinics like we've seen? What would be the differences between the first and the second shot administrations versus this third shot? Are there going to be campaigns to get people who are fully vaccinated their third shot? Have even those conversations even happened yet? I'm kind of curious because that seems to be a big topic moving forward.
Yeah, a couple thoughts about that, Alex. I mean, one, so many of those decisions really need to be rooted in the data, right? At this point, we don't know how long vaccine-mediated immunity will last. We know it lasts at least 6 months because that's about the amount of time that people, you know, started getting vaccinated in the clinical trials to now. We don't know if that's going to last 8 months, 12 months, or beyond. And so there was a forum earlier this week where Dr. Fauci, Dr. Bourla, who's the CEO of Pfizer, and then the CEO of Pharma, you know, kind of just were asked their thoughts, you know, what's going on with boosters. And clearly, Pfizer and Moderna have been working on boosters for months now because of the uncertainty around variants, right? We saw the emergence of the UK variant, South African variant. Now we're watching the Indian variant. And so they started to work on boosters that would incorporate some of the variants to provide additional protection. But what we're also seeing in the meantime is that the existing vaccine is actually incredibly effective against these variants. And so based on that alone, that wouldn't necessarily be a huge impetus to jump into boosters. Now, what would be is if at 8 months or 12 months, we started to see the impact of vaccination start to wane, right? If your immunity starts to drop, that's when you need a booster. So it's really hard to speculate on the timeline because so far, you know, 6 months in, immunity still looks really strong. And so I think, you know, my guess would be that we probably won't need to look to boosters until 2022. But to the second part of your question, we have a ton of infrastructure that we didn't have before in terms of supply chain and distribution, the pathway through providers and pharmacies. And so I think, you know, if we find that a booster is needed, we would clearly encourage it. But we also have many, many, many outlets where people can go to get this. And I don't know that we would need the same degree of, you know, mass vaccination infrastructure. Because remember, when we did that, we had no protection, right? Like nobody had been vaccinated, and only people who had actually contracted COVID had any kind of immunity. But now, as we're talking about the prospect of boosters, people still will have some degree of protection with waning immunity. So it's a very different context that will not require just the same degree of emergency response. And I think we can more effectively rely on our existing pathways in primary care providers and free clinics and health departments and pharmacies.
Thank you.
Our next question is from Cameron Thompson. Go ahead, your line's open.
Hey, Dr. Bourla, I was actually going to ask the exact same question about booster shots, so I'm good, thank you.
Thanks, Cam.
Our next question is from Brett Hall. Go ahead, your line's open.
Hey, Dr. Bourla, I was also going to ask about the boosters, but I also wanted to ask, I mean, is there any... Why, is there any, like, going to be a post-mortem on how this went in the health department from your standpoint? I know you've been running on the fly for 15 months now. But, you know, is there any – this vaccination process, is there going to be a look at how things could go better? Because, I mean, as experts have said, this might not be our last pandemic.
Yeah, it's really true, Brett. Yeah, no doubt there will be. We don't have a timetable for it yet, but we certainly have started talking to some of our partners about kind of doing a larger scale after-action review of our response. In some ways, I still feel like we're very much in the midst of our response, and while it feels really different than it did 4 months ago because of the scarcity at that point, because of the need to build up so much new infrastructure at that point, the fact remains that we are, you know, we've got a few months ahead of us before we're hitting our herd immunity goal. So I think it'll more likely be late fall or towards the end of this year where we pause, where we see how we've done and start to really think through think through every step of this and figure out what we need to learn from and what we need to improve upon the next go round. I think the other thing that is pretty clear is that there are hundreds of millions of dollars that are coming in. The federal government is directing to states and localities to improve the public health infrastructure. And so as that money starts to get committed, there will just be an ongoing reflection and assessment about what are those needs? What infrastructure do we need to build up? So I think towards the end of this year, we'll have a much more prescribed process for that after action reflection.
Okay, and actually the other question I was going to ask, and I'm not sure if you're the guy to answer this one, but because I know you weren't as involved in the contact tracing side, or you were, but not leading the effort. Will, as these, large venues, our large gatherings, get open back up, and if you have the center of this population that I know we've talked in the past about evangelical Christians, a lot of them being hesitant to get the vaccine, let's say you have a Christian concert somewhere, there's an outbreak. Will the health department be monitoring these outbreaks when the restrictions go away? Is that still going to be a part of this?
Definitely. I mean, I think, back to your earlier question of what infrastructure do we need to build, how do we need to be more prepared? A big part of that now and moving forward is having sufficient capacity for the case contact investigation and the contact tracing work. Yes, absolutely. That work will continue moving forward around COVID. We would do that with a lot of other disease states. And then I think the other piece that will really be helpful in those situations is our increased access to testing. We need to remember that as case rates decrease and more people get vaccinated, that those are all really good things, but testing is still a really important part of our overarching containment strategy. There are already a lot of federal dollars that are flowing in to increase access to testing as well.
All right. Thank you very much.
Next question is from Kate Andrews. Go ahead. Your line's open.
Hi there. So I wanted to ask you about the masking changes and, is there any aspect of that, rather abrupt change in direction, both nationally and in Virginia that concerns you? Do you think that there's going to be an uptick in spread, among people who have not been vaccinated, including younger children?
Yeah, clearly I hope not, Kate. I think that the data is really good around people who are vaccinated, right? And that's why the CDC came out with its guidance. It's why we aligned our policies and procedures to the CDC guidance. Hopefully that's an incentive for people to say, okay, now that the data is so good and there are newfound freedoms with being fully vaccinated, the hope is that it will drive many, many people to get vaccinated. I think it's happening at a good time just in terms of us moving into the warmer months and there being less transmission in general. And what we've seen so far, in the last couple of weeks, have been remarkably low rates, really dating back to the beginning of this pandemic. So I think we will keep a close eye on it. Things will continue to get better the more people will get vaccinated, and we will still urgently pursue, getting to that 70-80% mark for vaccinating everybody.
Okay. And secondly, how long do you expect to continue as vaccination coordinator for the state?
I'm looking at my transition plan now. It's hard to know. The work is very different now, but it still is important. And so sort of thinking through all of the strategies and really aligning the resources of the state, I'm hoping sometime over the summer I'll start to transition out.
Okay. Well, good luck. Thanks so much.
Thanks so much.
Our next question is from Jill Palermo. Go ahead. Your line's open.
Hi, Dr. Vula. Thanks so much for doing this again. My question is about who we're now targeting, as we go to try to, work toward this last,
however many percent it is now, less than 20% to herd immunity and then hopefully beyond that. But I'm wondering what information is the state looking at to determine who and how we should be targeting these last few folks? And also, you know, is there any new strategies that are being employed?
So with the first question, Jill, on who and how, I mean, we have, over the last few months, kind of taken a district by district and in many cases even a census tract by census tract look at what our vaccination rates are in each community. You know, we really rely on the expertise and experience of our local health districts and our network of partners to know, you know, what communities do we have lower vaccination rates in and how do we improve that. And so, you know, at a macro level, the macro state level, we've done really well in our 65 and up population. I mean, we're at 80%+ there. Where we are not doing as well, and it's not just us in Virginia, it's everybody, is young people. So if you look at, you know, kind of our teen 16 to 30 population, we're about 40% there. So there's a lot of focus on that segment of our community. We're starting to think through how do we need to reach that population better. We've used some community ambassadors in that age group, but I think it means doing more on-site at employers, like making it really convenient for young adults who aren't necessarily against being vaccinated, but just haven't been compelled to go make an appointment or to, you know, go out of their way to get vaccinated. And so I think by reducing those barriers, by making it as easy as possible, by showing up, all of the things that, you know, that we've talked about over the last couple of weeks, the ways that health departments are getting out in the communities, right? They're going to bars. They're going to grocery stores. They're going to places, to restaurants, to places where people are, setting up outside of baseball games and festivals. So I think those kinds of strategies kind of just put this front and center for a younger demographic who's not going to go out of their way to get vaccinated. And then I think, you know, social media is something that we have used widely through more traditional social media means, but I don't know that we have, like, maxed out our presence on TikTok or Instagram or Snapchat. That might lean towards the younger population. So our comms team is actively sort of thinking through what messaging and what media do we need to get to a younger demographic through.
Okay, and then thank you for that. And also, I have one more question about the when will we know it's time for a booster? When will we know it's time for a booster? Will we see cases picking up? I mean, are people going to have to be starting to test positive for us to know it's time for a booster?
I think that's one outcome that we could anticipate is just increasing case rates in people who have already been vaccinated, right? So the breakthrough case rate. I think in the background, the manufacturers and scientists are constantly doing studies to figure out what antibody counts you see at different stages beyond your vaccination date. And so I would guess in the next 3 to 6 months, we'll start to see studies that show, hey, you know, people who have been vaccinated start to have waning immunity at 9 months or at 12 months. So I think those are the two things that will likely point us towards the need for a booster, an increase in rate of breakthrough cases and the science telling us that immunity is waning in people who have been vaccinated.
Okay, thank you so much.
Our next question is from Sabrina Moreno. Go ahead, your line's open.
Hi, Dr. Bula, thank you so much. I also can't wait to see the TikTok. I think that'll make my day. So I have two questions for you today. The first is, I know we've talked about this before, we talked about it last week, but with Governor Hogan in Maryland kind of announcing yesterday that $2 million of an incentive program for people to get vaccinated and other states hinting at kind of shifting toward this to help with reaching that final leg of herd immunity, I was wondering what that might look like through the VDH's standpoint, all of these programs in other states are super tied to their health departments. And Maryland has higher vaccination rates than even Virginia. So I was kind of wondering if any new developments have occurred as we're seeing these announcements and more of them pop up across the country.
I mean, it's something we talk about every day and have been for several weeks. I don't know. I'm torn, Sabrina. I feel like there clearly are some benefits of incentivization. It'll be interesting to see what the longer term impact of that. Like for example, in Ohio, when they announced their big, you know, $5 million prizes, they saw a big jump in vaccination rates, but those have since fallen away. And I don't know. I think that people are kind of there are really good points on both sides of the incentivization argument, right? There are people who say the harder you try to get me to do this, the more I'm not going to do it. And there's also the kind of forward thinking, is this the precedent that we want to set, right? Like there are huge individual and practical incentives to getting vaccinated. The individual incentive being it protects you from getting COVID. It protects you from hospitalization and death. The practical one being you no longer have to wear a mask when you're fully vaccinated. And if you are, you know, as we start to think about younger people, school-aged children, the reality that you don't have to quarantine if you're potentially exposed and you don't have to miss school days or go back to hybrid school, or you don't have to miss 14 days from your sports team, right? There are all these very practical examples that will compel people to get vaccinated. But clearly sometimes we need a little bit more. So we are, I don't see us doing this large scale, use of federal funds or Virginia dollars to incent that way. I think what we will likely do is take a much more nuanced approach to segments of our community. So I think Jill asked a question earlier about, you know, how are we approaching, how are we doing this differently in some segments of our population? I mean, I think it's like if we go out to rural Virginia and we know we're seeing lower vaccination rates there, are there specific incentives that would move the needle? Things like, passes to state parks or hunting and fishing licenses like some other states have done. So at the end of the day, yes, we're thinking about incentives a lot. We are still making really good progress without this, and I think there is some hesitation, at least on my part personally, to overly rely on incentives for something that is inherently good, and I don't want to set a precedent that we can't meet with all other types of vaccination moving forward. But as we really want to get to herd immunity for the good of society, we'll have a more targeted and local approach to the way that we do that.
Yeah, thank you for that. And this is a separate issue, but I was wondering if you had if there were concerns on how the state is opening up next week, but the vaccination rates kind of vary based on income and locality. And so it's kind of a double question. Is the statewide percentage of people vaccinated enough to protect residents in those localities where, say, barely 30% of its population has received one dose?
No, because this disease spreads locally, right? So in communities that have really low vaccination rates, there is going to be more risk if people are not following the guidelines. And so if you're not vaccinated and you're not wearing a mask, then you're not only putting yourself at risk, but you're going to put your community at risk. And that is going to happen to a higher degree in communities that have lower vaccination rates. So I think the core message is, vaccination is good for you, it's good for everybody, and now we are confident in the science that if you're fully vaccinated, you can go mask-free. If you are not vaccinated, you really do need to wear a mask to protect yourself and to protect others.
Thanks, appreciate it.
Next question is from Shannon Lilly. Go ahead, your line's open.
Hi, Dr. Avula. This is Shannon Lilly with CDS6. My question is just, do you know where things stand as far as the number of people still missing second doses?
It's been a week or so since I pulled those numbers, Shannon. I'm sorry. Well, but I'll, what the last set of numbers we pulled, it was 6.7% of people who had their first dose and been 42 days out or more, so beyond that six-week recommended time period. Let me pull the numbers again, probably Monday, and then we'll have those. So we'll get them out. But that was at the end of last week, 6.7%.
Thank you so much.
Yeah.
Next question is from Heather Curtis. Go ahead, your line's open.
Hi, Dr. Avula. Heather Curtis from WMAL Radio. Thanks so much for taking our questions. I have a question about related to boosters. As you know, some places like Office Depot and Staples are offering to laminate vaccination cards for free. I was in a press call recently with the AAA, and they said, don't do that, because if you need a booster, they'll need to mark that down on your card, and if it's laminated, obviously that's not going to work. What's your advice on whether to laminate vaccine cards?
Yeah, it just seems like a very practical concern, right? Because once it's laminated, you can't write on it again. I don't know. I don't have strong feelings about it. I mean, I think if it helps you keep it in place and know where it is, I think I don't even know if there's room on there for a booster. I can't remember my card, I don't have a great answer. I'm sorry.
That's all right.
Put it in your purse or your wallet. That seems just as good.
And do you think that
people can always get new cards, right? I mean, so if that's a concern, you know, the place where you got vaccinated can always look it up and issue a new card.
Okay, so people who, if you don't need a booster until 2022, like you speculated, people won't be in trouble if they've lost their vaccination card between
right,
now and
exactly.
then. I'm sure lots of people will.
We show no further questions at this time.
And with that, I want to thank everybody for joining our call today. There will be an audio recording posted on the VDH website, as well as a written transcript. You'll be able to access these documents at vdh.virginia.gov/coronavirus/media-room. Once again, if we were unable to answer your questions today, please email them to the VDH Communications Office. Thank you.
That concludes today's conference. Thank you for participating. You may disconnect at this time.